Let's return to Live from the State Capitol with Fred Dicker here on Talk 1300.
I hope some of you had a chance to check out that remarkable profile of Sandy Lewis that was in the New York Times 3 or 4 weeks ago. It was one of the most unique profiles I've ever seen. Sandy Lewis Salem Lewis, he'll tell us how to pronounce his actual name, is the scion of one of the most famous figures on Wall Street back in the 1950s and 60s. His father was a key figure in running Bear Stearns and Company right up to his death in the late 1970s. And as I noted, Sandy Lewis wound up being convicted of a securities crime and then pardoned by President Clinton. The Times points out that even a federal judge said that what Sandy Lewis was convicted of doing was an attempt to expose improper conduct, not criminal conduct. And most recently, Sandy Lewis became really famous in the Adirondacks for taking on the APA and beating them, even though he's not against the APA per se. He was against the APA violating the law by telling him that he couldn't build farm housing on his property when there's an explicit exemption for that. He beat them back. He won legal fees. As a result, he's a guy who's battled a lot of people over the years, and I think he's battling some more right now. We're going to talk about that with Sandy Lewis. Good morning, Sandy. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Fred.
Good to have you. How does that, your name, is it your first name is actually S-A-L-I-M, is that right? Salim?
Yes, I was baptized as Salem.
Salem.
B-O-N-N-O-R Lewis.
All right. You were baptized.
Baptized. My mother was an Episcopalian. Yep.
Fair enough. Well, good to have you with us, Sandy. It's been a while since we talked. Last we talked, you were talking about the potential for a high-quality slaughterhouse in the Adirondacks. I thought that was an interesting discussion, even though some of my listeners have found it a little offensive. They don't like to discuss abattoirs. What's the latest with it? Before we talk about what you want to talk about, let me just ask you if there's anything new in terms of getting a high-quality humane slaughterhouse up in the Adirondacks.
Can't speak about humane. There is one that's opening shortly. I think it's in the Ticonderoga area. I don't know anything about it. I do know that it required special permission, and I do know that government helped it. That's all I know.
Well, is that good news? Is that a slaughterhouse you're likely to use for your cattle?
We use an organic slaughterhouse in Athol, A-T-H-O-L, Massachusetts. And our principal client is Deerfield Academy, which wants the grass-fed product. We're USDA certified grass-fed. We're the only one in the country that is. That's why they want us.
Which is pretty amazing. And just in terms of this new slaughterhouse, though, right now you have not likely you're going to be using it. You don't know anything about it. Is that right?
I actually don't.
Okay.
I was asked if I favored it. All I could say is I don't oppose it. This was a request from government, from an elected official. The APA had some minimal involvement. I think it's in a hamlet. The more the merrier. If they want to open it, that's fine. It has to be organic to suit us. And I don't know if they are.
I had asked you this before. What is this? How does the slaughterhouse become organic? I mean, organic.
The federal government inspects the slaughterhouse,
right,
and passes it for that purpose. And those of us who wish to slaughter organic have to be first on the floor on a given day after they've cleansed the place, and then when we're done, the non-organic animals come through.
So an organic slaughterhouse doesn't allow the organically raised animals to come in contact with anything?
You have to be on the kill floor and passing through the system long before they bring in animals that are not organic.
Fair enough. Sandy, you had mentioned to me when we had chatted on the phone, and this is something I think a lot of people can identify with, that you're battling with your local assessor over assessments on your farm up there. I think everybody wishes they had the resources to battle their local assessor. Can you tell us what's going on? What town is this?
Very quickly, it's Essex County,
right,
in the town of Essex.
Okay.
And they have assessed us at over $6 million. Actually, we didn't pay a lot of attention to that for a few years because we were in the APA fight. As the APA fight wound down, we took a look at that, found it unreasonable, filed the appropriate objections, and without hesitation and without an examination, they've never set foot on the property, they reduced it from 6 and change to 4 and change.
Just like that?
Just like that. We then retained counsel and have sued the town and the county, whoever you sue for these things, and they came down to 4. Then they said they would settle. There's been no effort to settle. We filed our papers. They haven't filed theirs. The town cleared an $80,000 fee for some lawyer, Hiscock, whatever it is, and
Barclay.
Those folks have yet to file a piece of paper. And I might add that we've looked carefully at the expert they've brought in to assess the property, and to our knowledge, he's never done a farm.
Hmm.
So they've spent 60 of the 80 that we know of. They've probably spent all of it. They haven't done anything yet, and we're in the position of simply not paying them until they get around to it. We figure they'll negotiate sooner or later.
Well, do you have a sense that because you're seen, and I guess quite correctly, as one of the more wealthy individuals living in the town and living in the Adirondacks, that you get targeted? I've heard of that certainly at Lake George and with other resort properties where people who are seen as sort of not local and are very wealthy get really hit very hard by assessment.
I'll quote our local vet, who is a wonderful woman. She and her husband run a terrific practice in Westport. What she said is, "You're the cash cow of Essex." That's what she said to me.
She didn't say cash organic cow. She just said cow.
She just said cash cow, and she couldn't be nicer, and she couldn't be more capable.
What was your annual property tax bill when they had you assessed at $6 million? Something over
100,000?
80 over 80,000.
Huh? Yep.
And in terms of your settlement and your victory with the APA, could you talk a little bit about that? Because I gather there's some fallout now involving the lawyer who had represented you in the APA case.
This is a complicated story. I don't know how to quite give it to you, but it works this way. After we were done with the APA, there was a negotiated settlement organized for us by Betty Little in the governor's office. Our counsel knew nothing about it. And the reason our counsel knew nothing about it is because every time he had a shot, he wanted to send more papers to the court and run up more time.
What's his name?
John Privatera.
Okay.
He has an associate named Jacob Lamy. They're with the firm of McNamee something or other. At the end of the day, that firm represented us. We'd had a previous firm represent us, and they'd done a terrible job, Nixon Peabody.
A major firm upstate.
Well, they're in Rochester, and they have an Albany office, and they're all over the place. They're a big firm.
Yeah.
They did a terrible job. The partner who did that job is no longer with them. If I'm not mistaken, he's chasing ambulances. His name is David Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our case, my wife had the case. She was working this with Mr. Cook. And she threw up her hands when she was abused by the APA. And some of the same staff remain there. Most of them have gone. They sacked the chairman. They sacked the general counsel. I mean, the whole place is under review. And Betty Little has been fabulous. But in our case, our counsel, with whom we are in dispute, decided that it was a good thing to file with the court, same court that handled the case, some sort of a pleading to get money back from the government, which we did. He handled all of this, and as I put it to him, this is on you, pal. You go ahead and do it if you want to. I'm perfectly happy to see it happen. We were rewarded $71,690.28, which was 31% of that which was corrected, requested, I believe. In any event, what we found in the pleadings and in the papers that were submitted to the court, and we found this because we have farm counsel here who's pretty smart, she looked at these papers and she said, "We have lied to the court."
Hmm.
I was astounded.
Right.
I said, "What have we done?" Well, it turns out that we told the court we were sending them all the bills. The bills approach $400,000. We showed them, I think, $230,000, give or take. And, you know, the judge here in this case is a pretty courageous fella, and we didn't tell him the truth. And then we also see where certain items which were on the bills were misplaced, and it's deliberate, so that the dates were changed on items, I think there were two, placed so that we could ask the court to collect on the time spent for those particular items. I'm not familiar with all the details, but that's the gist of it. I was horrified, called our own counsel, who was supposed to be copied on all this stuff, and never was. Same thing happened with Nixon Peabody. And I called our county clerk, and I asked them both, isn't this malpractice? Should we not run this guy into an ethics charge? First, it was in the middle of the case, and all the rest.
Well, excuse me for a second here, Sandy. What would have been the intent? Where's the malpractice? Is it just sloppiness, or was it an attempt to cheat
deliberate.
Somehow?
This guy's too smart to be sloppy. He's very
running
very
up his
clever.
Bill? Is that what it was, in your view?
Well, he ran up our bills, yes. Right. That was ridiculous, and the judge said as much. If you read the judge's opinion in rewarding 31% of that which was requested, he basically said, and he said it in simple language, according to the counsel here, he was abusive, quote-unquote, said John Privatera. Now, Privatera billed us, and at the day when this all ended, we'd stopped paying him at $87,000, and the bill, you know, was close to $300,000, and he came to us to collect. I said, "Well, let's negotiate." He started screaming, and that lasted for half an hour. And I said, "John, I'd be very happy to negotiate this bill." with you. No mention of what would be negotiated, just the concept.
Right.
He refused because if he can get the court to give him what he wants, he'll get the full bill plus 9%.
From the state?
No.
From you. Okay.
Sure. And in this case here, we have Judge Meyer's view in court papers. And there was a curious development, and I think it was in the summer of 2010, sometime into July, early part of August. I think it was the 29th, but I wouldn't swear to it. I got a call from our lawyer, Mr. Privatera, who's involved in a case called the Grimditch case. Jim Brooks of Lake Placid is in charge of that case, as far as I know. In any event, Mr. Privatera asked me to appear in court to sit with him in that case.
Right.
He called a couple of days in advance. I said, why do you need me there? He said, well, Judge Meyer regards you with favor, and I don't think he regards me with favor. I said, why doesn't he regard you with favor? He was noncommittal on that one, but he asked me to sit with him. And I said, of course, I would do my best to get there and all that. So the day came and went, and I didn't go. And he apparently rose to present his client's view. He was trying to intervene in this matter. I think it's still going on. The judge dismissed him. And according to Mr. Privatera, the judge dismissed him with some force by rearranging the courtroom so he'd have no place to sit. Yeah, well, you know, I didn't quite get this.
Right.
I really
strange story,
Fred. I didn't get it. What I began to realize, and it came to me late, and you've seen this in the press, when it came time to settle with the government and get our money back from our prosecution, when we defended ourselves, 71-2, whatever it was, the $72,000 was going to be given to us in Albany if, as, and when. Well, the CAST conference revealed all this stuff, and both the government and our lawyer decided to go in cahoots with each other and suppress the court papers.
Hmm.
So they wanted to turn the judge's decisions and all the pleadings into a dead record, just kill it.
Yeah, you've talked about that before, and you refused that, right?
Giveaway. That's
right.
When I began to realize that something had gone wrong here, and that this lawyer was ashamed of his work, and that the court was down on him for it as obsessive. Or excessive. So that's what we're fighting, and we are fighting it.
See, you have a legal action against your lawyer, or he's got one against you, or you're countersuing?
For his bill.
Right.
We, of course, have responded. We're going to publish this entire record at sblewis.com. The judge in question here is Richard M. Platkin. I don't know the first thing about him, except that he's a Pataki appointment in the early stages of Mr. Pataki's first year in the governor's office, and you have actually written about him. I don't know if you remember that or not, but you published on this office and on this judge.
Yeah, I remember him. He was, I think, assistant counsel, or he may have been actually counsel to the governor for
a while.
That's
correct.
Yeah.
We don't know who he is, but
right.
He is chosen randomly to opine on this, and his decision is as follows. Should Judge Platkin find in our favor, this matter will be heard in Essex County by Judge Meyer, I guess. But in any event, it wouldn't be fought in Albany, which is not where the case was heard in the first place. All the action was in Essex County. Nothing took place in Albany. Repeatedly, I refused to go to Albany on this matter, even in the CASP conference situation. And, of course, Mr. Privatera would prefer to have it heard right in his hometown with Platkin or whoever else it might be. And we're pleading to ask the Albany judicial authorities to release this matter, send it back to where the case was fought. And, of course, we don't want summary judgment. We would like the opportunity to either argue the case on the merits or to return to the original concept of negotiating with Mr. Privatera, which would be my choice. I think litigation is a waste of money.
Sandy, you may find this interesting. A few minutes ago, a Capital Confidential, which is the blog of the Times Union, tweeted out an item about the conversation you and I are having right now. And I'm looking at the tweet right now. It says, Sandy Lewis, now on air with FUD 31, that's me, can turn every story into a James Ellroy novel. This is not criticism, and they recommend listening. Are you familiar with James Ellroy at all?
No, and I've never tweeted and don't know what tweet is.
No, you know what it is. You've heard about it.
I've heard of it, of course, but we don't know how to do that here in this family. I'm 73, my wife is 76, and I can tell you this.
All right, bring up the violins. Meanwhile, you have one of the most sophisticated websites that are out there, so somebody knows how to do something.
Well, we do have Ark Lamal, and he will be mounting. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to put the court record that's in Judge Platkin's chambers in its entirety. We're going to publish the Grimditch case, where Mr. Privatera asked me to sit in the courtroom with him to enhance his prospects with Judge Meyer. We're going to do what we can to give disclosure, and I will offer to anybody in the press the best possible disclosure, documents, or anything else they want. What we see here, and I spoke with one of the local lawyers here in the North Country, and in fact, I think the most respected of the bunch. This guy said yesterday, Mr. Lewis, you should have turned him in way back when. Well, I didn't. And I didn't because people felt that if I'd gone to the appropriate authorities with his behavior, instead, by the way, I published, look at the appeals page. Look at the appeals page at sblewis.com. Adam Liptak of the New York Times on August 27, 2007, published the top jurist here in the state, the top federal jurist here in the state. And that guy had given a speech. He's a famous man. I'm trying to think of his name at the moment, and it's escaping me, but this guy's brilliant. And it's on my website, on the appeals page. And I published that, and when Privatera asked me why I put it up, I said, because of you. I said, that's what you're doing. You're doing what the top appeals court judge is accusing you, all lawyers, of doing with all judges. So I put it on the web page. I've been asked a million times, why did I put it there? There's a Benjamin Barton who also worked with him, and honest to God, Fred, I'm getting old. I can't remember the name of this famous judge who's the top jurist in the appeals court federal system for New York State, but he published on this.
Okay.
And his language is precise. It applies precisely to the kind of behavior you're seeing with Privatera, but in this case, unlike so many other judges, this judge blew up. Just ripped this guy and gave us 31% of the situation. Just, it's been a very painful experience for us. We're not getting any younger around here, and fighting with the town on taxes, fighting with the APA over the obvious, and then having your own lawyer turn on you is really an unpleasant experience.
I'm sure. Sandy, we only have a few minutes remaining. Let me ask you this. How did you get the New York Times? Why did the New York Times write such an incredible story about you? It must have been 5 pages long, computer screen pages. It was a remarkable story. Why do you think you warranted it, and what kind of response did you get, just quickly?
The response has been overwhelming. It's a tough story to tell. I admire the reporters for writing it. I do. What's not said there, and by the way, the judge I couldn't remember, it's coming to me in just a half a second. I'm gonna know it.
Okay.
It's the way my brain works. But wait a second. Oh, God, I've got it right here. Just let my head. It's not coming to me. I'm sorry. I really am sorry about this. My brain isn't working. But the truth. Pose your question again, Fred.
Well, let me just note that the story about you was written by Michael Powell and Danny Hakem, and it appeared on September 15.
I went to them and begged them to do it in 07. And then they came out with it. They were going to run it in 08. It was going to run in the magazine, and I have a bad temper, as people know, and I saw the magazine on different levels.
So it's been in the work for 5 years, basically,
yeah,
4 or 5 years.
The point is they were ready to go at the time Obama was elected, and I actually voted for him, which I will not do again.
Right.
And this situation, you know, matured, and they were ready to go to publish.
Well, it's a remarkable...
I started reading the magazine. I saw articles in the magazine I couldn't stand.
Right.
And I asked them to cease and not do it, and they refused. They were going to go ahead. So I called the guy who ran the magazine.
We only have a minute left. A minute left, Sandy.
I called Maserati's office and told him to get the damn story out of there. I didn't want to be published. I was ashamed to be in his magazine.
Say something about the response you got to it, though, because it really is an incredible story, just in 45 seconds. Did you hear from a lot of people?
Fred, the phone hasn't stopped ringing from Hong Kong, from Africa,
wow.
From places you can't believe. It makes me cry to see the kind of pain that people are living with, and some people who know what it's like to be incarcerated, in my case, in a mental institution. It wasn't fun, let me tell you. And I sympathize with every single caller. I just wish I could help him. We cannot.
Sandy Lewis, we thank you for joining us this morning from the Adirondacks, where he battles on and has a remarkable farm. Look forward to having you on again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Fred.
Sandy Lewis. This is Fred Dicker live at the State Capitol. I'm going to take a break, and we'll be right back.